Last year, I shared this thought, and I'd like to do it again because I think it's so fitting for this group, but this is something I heard years ago, and I've never forgotten. The hallmarks of history are neither in the keening of the crowds, nor in the thunder of the conquerors, but in the heartbeats of the handful who skirmish into the lonely unknown beyond security. Our next speaker, I believe, is such a man. So please welcome John Mack.
Thank you, Ron. I certainly can recognize that business about going into insecure realms. That's very familiar to me. Well, I want to talk with you about what I've been finding over the past now nearly 6 years in studying this alien abduction phenomenon, but particularly in the context of this meeting, to talk with you about ways that we know. How do we know? What's the appropriate epistemology for a particular subject? Seems to me all science, all knowledge really, is about the discovery of patterns, and that includes the patterns of meaning. But how we know, the approach that we use, depends on what the matter at hand happens to be. Now, for the sake of clarity here, I would divide the realms that we're considering here between what's been called the gross material world on the one hand, and the subtle realm on the other, or in Stan Grof's language, the hylotropic world or the holotropic world, or in David Bohm's terms, the explicate or manifest order, or the implicate or the hidden order and patterning of structure and meaning in the universe. Now, by and large, science, as it's traditionally spoken of, has addressed and its methodology has been appropriate to the gross material world, the physical world, the manifest world. And the approach has been largely dualistic. A separate observer studying phenomena outside of that person. Now, we know that in the best scientists don't use that approach, but that's the standard that we often think we mean or are told we mean by the scientific method. I might add that in the focus on that realm, to the exclusion of the subtle realm, we have virtually rid the cosmos of nature, rid nature of spirit and in a sense of all life, other than that which is physically observable here on Earth. Now, what do we mean by the subtle realm? And this is not so, as I began to think about this more deeply, it's not so easy to pin down. It has to do with phenomena that seem to come from another dimension. Telepathy, clairvoyance, the whole psi realm, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, telekinesis, and the alien abduction phenomenon itself. That is, phenomena where they may manifest in the physical world, but they seem to originate in some other dimension, something unseen. I don't know exactly where Brian would put his free energy notion in that realm. Again, something which is not readily observable under ordinary separatist, dualistic, scientific, or methodological conditions. Now, one of the fundamental tenets of the mechanistic or the dualistic approach is that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the human brain. So one of the assumptions we have to challenge is that one. In other words, that if we're going to study these subtle realms, which involve consciousness, and as we've heard, the relationship of consciousness to the material world, we have to recognize that consciousness, spirit, self, soul, all those realms have a life, have an existence separate from the physical body. And that's, for me, was a very great leap, and I had to do my own self-exploration through the work with Stan Grof and a great deal of challenging of my own kind of materialist scientific upbringing, clinical upbringing, to come to appreciate that fundamental kind of parting of the ways between the materialist scientific approach and one which can begin to allow us to study more profoundly these subtle realms. Now, the Western worldview, Michael Zimmerman calls anthropocentric humanism, which is a worldview that has reduced reality to the manifest or physical world and puts the human mind, the human being, at the top of the intellectual hierarchy, eliminating not only God, but all spirit from the cosmos. Now, the phenomena that really shake up that worldview are the phenomena that seem to cross over from the unseen world and manifest in the physical world. That's why someone like Uri Geller has been hounded from pillar to post. That's why people that study free energy or people who study phenomena that seem to challenge that great divide we've created between the unseen realm and the physical world. It works okay as long as you give the theologians and the spiritual people, maybe the psychologists, the mandate over that subtle realm, that unseen world, and let the scientists worry about the physical world, the material world. But if a phenomenon crosses over, if it won't obey those characterizations, that raises all hell in the culture, in this culture. Now, the phenomenon that I'm studying is just such a phenomenon. There are others. The near-death experience, the free energy phenomenon, telekinesis. But this is the one that I've studied, and I think it's one that, by its very nature, kind of grabs us where we are, because it crosses over and manifests in the language that we understand in this culture. You know, spaceships, abductions, implants, instruments, surgery, hybrids, babies, reproduction, all that seems very physical, very material. It ought to be reducible, studyable by the methods of dualism, of traditional science, but it won't yield its secrets. Not only that, but it commits a deeper crime, which is it challenges that very sacred divide that we've created between the unseen world and the material world. It challenges the fundamental worldview of the Western mind. Now, a whole new frontier, which I'm not going to get into much, but just refer to, has to do with our attachments to a worldview. Why do we cling so tightly to a worldview? What makes it so fundamental? And I don't think it's just that there are huge economic attachments, which there are, of course, to a worldview. I mean, the whole marketplace mentality of technology and of science as we know it is challenged by a worldview that says that there are vast, subtle realms, vast realms unavailable to our direct observation, and that, in fact, the worldview in which we are embedded is destroying its own playground, destroying the Earth itself. But there's more to it than that, because a worldview organizes our sense of self. It gives us the illusion that we have some control of ourselves, of nature, that we're in charge, that we're safe. Never mind that we all die, and perhaps die lonely deaths in this particular worldview, because since we've rid the cosmos of all consciousness, of all spirit, of God itself, of God and him or herself, that we never come to grips with the notion of death itself, and so there's a terrible loneliness in this worldview. The fact is, though, that it organizes our sense of self, it organizes reality for us, and constricts reality so that we have some illusion of control. So when a worldview is challenged and shattered, it creates a terror. And I think that the resistance which I've encountered, which naively I rather underestimated. People say, well, didn't you know if you started saying that, you know, little green men were taking men, women, and children, and there were spirits and funny beings coming and do it, didn't you realize that you would run into this resistance? And I guess I'm a little like that frog that, you know, where you heat the water slowly and he finally boils, you know. And I think it kind of snuck up on me, you know, because I've been at this for so many years and I didn't say anything publicly till I kind of felt I was pretty clear what I was doing. I had hundreds of hours with these individuals. But I'm interested in the resistance because I've had to deal with it, and I've had to deal with it, as you, I think, realize, one of the most powerful expressions of this resistance has been within my own university, where I've undergone a kind of investigation of my work, which surprised me. I must say that it stirred that much. But now I think I do appreciate that if an institution like Harvard Medical School or a church or any deep institution that's deeply connected with a worldview has that worldview basically challenged, and I think contemporary medicine is based largely on a materialist worldview, mechanistic worldview, then the empire will strike back. I mean, it will. You all know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, you've been there. So again, I guess you have to be a little naive to wander, as Ron was saying, off into those insecure realms, or you won't go there. If you know what you're going to encounter, right? You have to be naive in a certain sense, because, I mean, if somebody said, would you do it again if you had to do it over again? And I'd have to think about that, you know? Anyway, we came to a kind of, you know, if what Brian said, if Bertrand, you know, if it's true what Bertrand Russell said about resistance being proportional to the square of the importance of what you're studying, I must be studying something very, very important. So that kind of has encouraged me, you know, that the resistance and that statement of Russell's I find very helpful. We've come to a kind of amicable agreement at Harvard. I mean, they don't necessarily buy what I'm finding, and they don't buy my methods, but there hasn't been any charges, really. I mean, there's nothing that they can, I mean, I go about what I do as conscientiously as I can, and there is a respect for the right to do that, and so we kind of are at a sort of amicable juncture of agreeing to differ, but I've committed no crime, really, other than the ideological one of doing something which fundamentally challenges a worldview upon which so much is invested. So I appreciate, in a sense, what I've encountered in this resistance, and I think it's maybe a useful thing for all of us, in a way, to know something more deeply about what we're encountering in the way of resistance to what we're doing, because if we can embrace that polarity, perhaps we can go to a deeper level instead of always, as we tend to do, finding ourselves in opposition against those people that won't take in what we're trying to do. All right. Just one more word about this challenge to worldview that these crossover phenomena like the alien abduction story represent. If you look at the kind of blows to human kind of collective egocentrism, you know, from starting with Copernicus and Galileo and going on to Darwin and then Freud, where little by little we were not only not at the center in terms of geography of the universe. We were not at the center in terms of being the only God-given creatures. And with Freud, we weren't really even in charge of our own psychology. And finally, we learn from this that we're not the smartest guys in the universe after all. In fact, we're not even in control in any sense. That other beings, funny-looking ones at that. They're not even good-looking, most of them, you know. If they were those magnificent Nordics, you know, we hear about, or, you know, were the principal aliens, but these little guys with big black eyes can come and do what they will with us and render us helpless. I mean, that is really a fourth blow, you know, after what Copernicus, Darwin, Freud, to our collective arrogance, and of course being a bit perverse as a psychiatrist, I think anything that can be a big blow to human arrogance can only be a good thing in terms of our development. I mean, something we had no shortage of, right? So I mean, it can help us to grow. Now, before launching into my specific work, I just want to say another word about how is a worldview maintained in a culture. And I brought in this notion what I call the politics of ontology, which is how a society organizes itself, particularly through a certain elite group, to determine for the rest of that society what is real. It's a kind of governance of ideas. And in this culture, there may be a very tiny group, you know, a certain small group of scientists, not all scientists, you know, the Carl Sagan group, and he's not the most rigid people, but there are some people that have, you know, declared this, people like me and you, just like totally irrational, you know, and they decide that, and they control the mainstream media, and certain government groups that decide what's reality. We are people that know a lot about that. You're going to be hearing more about that. So a very small elite group decide what is the prevailing worldview, what is the nature of reality. Now, so the politics around determining the nature of reality is a particular politics that we haven't really thought about that much. We think about the politics of economics and of governance, of communities, of the social order, but not how we are governed around what we're supposed to think is real. Now, an interesting thing is happening, though, in this culture, and Michael Zimmerman has pointed this out. With the mass media, with public education being as extensive as it is, everybody's getting kind of smart, right? People know their experiences. They know they've had experiences that don't fit the prevailing mechanistic worldview. Not just you guys who are all here, but wherever I go to talk about this, 80 to 90 to 95 to 98% of the people, they know there's an unseen world. They know there's a hidden dimensions of reality. They know there are subtle realms. They may not use this kind of language, but they know their own experiences and they trust their experiences, and they're not fooled by NBC or by the New York Times or Time Magazine or those official arbiters of the truth and reality. So that we have this kind of samistat of reality going on here, this undercurrent of knowledge that the world, the universe, is not the universe we're being officially told it is. So it's really going to be an interesting thing to see when the mainstream of the culture, when this 1 or 2% elite that determines what we're supposed to think is real, suddenly wakes up to the fact that it's not being bought. You know, it's going to be an interesting moment. We're getting near that moment, I think. Okay. So let's go back to the subtle realm, and Margaret Mead wrote this in 1974 in Red Book magazine. I didn't know that was such a radical journal in those days, but she said, people still ask each other, do you believe in UFOs? I think this is a silly question, born of confusion. Belief has to do with matters of faith. It has nothing to do with the kind of knowledge that is based on scientific inquiry. When we want to understand something strange, something previously unknown to anyone, we have to begin with an entirely different set of questions. What is it? How does it work? Are there recurrent regularities? And I resonate with that because I'm always being accused of being a believer, you know, somebody who's kind of gone over the edge from rationality to belief. And this has nothing, as she says, my work has nothing to do with belief. It has to do with what I do as a clinician. I began to see people in the beginning of 1990, it's now 5.5 years, who were describing experiences who seemed of sound mind, describing experiences which simply did not fit into any kind of psychiatric category that I could conceive of. Child abuse, psychosis, neurosis, organic brain, this or that, fantasy prone, blah, on and on and on. You know the whole litany of this. There were patterns here. We're talking about science. And I just couldn't find any explanation for any of this. And I'll say, I always say this to audiences, there is not a single abduction case which fulfills the really rather simple criteria of an authentic case, which is that the person reports, with or without hypnosis or with or without a relaxation exercise, observing some kind of humanoid beings being taken against their will, not always traumatically, but not with their own choice, into some kind of enclosure and subjected to intrusive, both traumatic and sometimes elevating procedures. That's, you know, there are now thousands of those cases described. The patterns are very clear down to very, very specific details, and not one of those cases has been shown to have a cause other than what the person says happened to them, right? There isn't a single case that's revealed this is behind this as some kind of strange depression or child abuse or something else. And clinicians have made intense efforts to find this to be something else because the motivation is very strong to shoot this down, to find another cause, what I call the anything but syndrome. Anything but that we are being visited by some kind of strange intelligence that is entering our world in just this way. But the methodological issues here are important. How do we know? How do I do this? In a way, it's easier for a clinician, a psychological clinician, psychiatrist, whatever, because that's the way we always work. We are not basically people who get anywhere by standing back from somebody and observing them as specimens. The way we always work, if we're going to be useful and helpful and truthful with people, is by entering into their worlds, by a kind of intuitive use of our total self, as Dr. Pond was talking about, where we use our intellect, we use inspiration, we use intuition, we use everything, our total selves, our total psyches, our total consciousness. Consciousness is, in effect, our instrument of knowing. Here, from the beginning of our field, if we're doing it right, if we haven't pretended, if we haven't sold out and gone over and tried to act like physicists or biologists, but are true to our roots as psychological professionals, then it should come naturally that the way we learn in this field is participatory. It's non-dualistic. It's a kind of relational way of knowing. Now, it's very easy for people coming from the dualistic approach to say, well, you're contaminating the field. You're influenced, you're leading. And it's very difficult to deal with that argument in a sense because you're not leading. And as in part of my defense, I had everybody I'd worked with address that question in affidavits, and not one said I led them. They said I challenged them. But you can't get away from the fact that you have two or more, consciousnesses in a sense interacting, energy fields connecting, and that what emerges is out of that participation, out of that relationship. Then after you do that, you look at what you've got, and then you apply a rational judgment of what is this material? Was this person trying to please me? Was this authentic? What was the emotional intensity that came with it? Was the emotion appropriate to what they're talking about? All the things that psychological clinicians do to assess, is this something that you believe in this, not belief as religious belief, but believe because you feel the person is authentically communicating to you what as best they can tell you occurred. Also, the people that I work with, and again, these are the kind of things that go into a clinical assessment, they doubt as much as I do what's going on. In other words, they all will often come to me saying, you know, can you make this go away? They'll say it's a dream. Or this strange thing is, they want it to be found to be part of their psyche, not to be real. And I've seen case after case after case where the lips quiver, tears come down the person's cheeks. They become stunned at the moment in the session where they realize it, they weren't asleep, it was not a dream. or that I tell them, yes, I'm sorry, but I know many people have had these experiences as well, just like you. And then they realize, and one woman said to me a few days ago, but if it's real, then it can happen again. And I can't stop it, and you can't stop it. They want it to be a clinical phenomenon that will go away, or that I can cure, give them a pill, or talk them out of it, or interpret it in some dynamic sense, which of course is what many of my colleagues want to do as well. So the method here is a method of use of consciousness, my total self, my whole background, my very being, to be with a person, to create a safe environment in which the person can share, bring forth that which is the most sensitive, most troubling, most confusing, most extraordinary for them kind of experiences that are imaginable, at least in this worldview, in this culture. And I've worked intensively now with over 100 people, done hypnosis or some kind of, it's not really hypnosis, it's a kind of relaxation response where the person closes their eyes and just goes back inside. And contrary to what you hear about hypnosis bringing distortions, I trust often what will come out in those relaxation sessions, because the feelings are so intense. The person is able to bring forth much more ignoble kinds of experiences, more humiliating experiences often of being on the ship and having a cup put over his penis and ejaculate against his will and that kind of thing, rather than when the person tells you in conscious memory, they tend to organize it in a way that's less humiliating, more appropriate to their sense, their self-regard. And the basic phenomenon of abductions, and this does not mean, by the way, again, there's no statement you can make in this field that's 100% true, that there are paradoxes all over the place. For example, not every case, I don't believe every case of abduction that the physical body is taken, yet there are many cases in which the person is witnessed to be not there when a child, for example, goes into the mother's room at night and the mother's gone and the mother reports an abduction experience at that time. But there are also cases where the person is experiencing abduction and other people observe they still are there. But the basic phenomenon, the intrusion of humanoid beings into the person's life, the experience of being taken through walls, beam of light, paralyzed some kind of enclosure and subjected to a variety of procedures that are intrusive, that result in the creation of some kind of hybrid species, involve very powerful information about the threats to the planet, nuclear war, ecological change, the phenomenon of the expansion of consciousness that occurs for the people that undergo these experiences, and also for people that work with them and the people that will listen to what this, to, you know, will be open to what this is about. I mean, the phenomenon is consistent, and it's consistent worldwide. My colleague Dominique Kalamanopoulos and I have been traveling to Southern Africa, to Brazil, many countries in Europe. We're getting reports from all over the world that the basic phenomenon has a core of reality to it. We work with a South African medicine man, Credo Mutwa, who's a Zulu leader of his people, and when he was 38, he had a classic abduction experience, which was part of his training as a shaman. He was in the bush, suddenly he's in an enclosure, there's these humanoid beings with the big black eyes are around him. He's terrified, they do something to his penis. He says he thinks his first wife left him because it left some harm to his penis. At the same time, he also talks very intensively about how the Mandindas, as this Zulus call the alien beings, the Mandindas are trying to teach us about the threat to the earth, about the environment, about what's happening here. And we've similarly found a case in a Brazilian farmer, absolutely classical abduction case. So this is another frontier that we're exploring. Now, what is the, and I'm going to spend a little time here talking about what I see to be the pattern and meaning of the alien abduction phenomenon based on my work with this well, it's actually, I've met with about 200 abductees, but worked intensively with over 100, and then regressions with between 60 and 70. What is the pattern of this phenomenon? What is the, and that includes the meaning of it. First of all, abductees are being told this over and over and over again, that this is occurring in the context of the threat to the Earth as a living system. This is some kind of response to the ecological devastation that this particular species has undertaken, which doesn't mean that something related to this phenomenon hasn't existed from before the early 60s and the Betty Barney Hill case, but in its present intense form, it's related to the destruction of the Earth. Credo Mutwa, the African medicine man, said that the Earth in African mythology is one of what they call mother planets. There are 25 mother planets in the cosmos, and we're destroying one of them. And as one of the abductees put it, this is a cosmic, an effort at a cosmic correction, that the Earth has a place in a larger fabric of meaning and significance in the cosmos, and this one species cannot be allowed to destroy it for its own egoistic purposes. So this other intelligence is a kind of intermediary between source and us, is a kind of emissary of that correction, which doesn't mean that every alien being is in that mission. I'm not saying that, but this is a dominant pattern that I get in case after case, and relates to the principal set of beings that we're dealing with. Next, that the message comes through to us over and over and over again. And I'm going to give you some clinical material related to this, that we have lost connection with what the aliens and the humans that have these experiences call source, or home with a capital H, source with a capital S, which is the divine core of creativity, the light. Different traditions have ways of talking about this, but we have come too far from that. We have lost that connection. Next, that these encounters are changing consciousness of the people that are undergoing it, and I believe changing consciousness on the planet, in order to bring us back and reconnect us with source. The hybrid program, which can be deeply traumatic for the people, the mothers and fathers who are brought back to see these hybrid children that they can't know when they're going to be able to see again or asked to bond with them. The hybrid program is a kind of awkward insurance policy for the next step of evolution. We don't know what reality those hybrids exist in. It could be some intermediate dimension between the material world and the unseen world. But it's the step of evolution that is being created in the cosmos as if we had destroyed ourselves and all the other hundreds of thousands of species that we're destroying. And finally, the human-alien relationship is neither good nor bad. It's hurtful, it's harmful, it's traumatic, but it just is. It's reciprocal. It's not simply about what their motives are, what our motives are. We don't know from what dimension of source the whole thing is being orchestrated, but it's reciprocal and it serves them and us. Or it serves evolution, perhaps. Perhaps it serves neither of us, neither species. Now I'm going to tell you about the case of Barbara. She's a 34-year-old mother of four children. Her oldest son was killed violently in an automobile accident several months ago, and her abduction experiences, her encounters have been important in her being able to integrate that terrible loss and put it in some kind of larger cosmic perspective. She's had just about every type of abduction experience you can imagine, from the being used for this breeding project, to having a dual identity, both serving the aliens and being identified with them and doing their work, as well as being experiencing the trauma of it. She has a complex religious background. She has Central American origin, where she has both African-derived religious background and is also raised as a Christian. So, and she's been struggling to overcome the victim status of her abduction experiences, to transform the experience, to grow from the experience, and she has undergone profound kinds of transformation in the context of her encounters. The session that I'm going to quote some transcript material from occurred on July 31st. This summer, she had had ongoing encounters with the beings during the days before that. She struggled with those encounters to change them into one in which there was more reciprocal exchange. She felt they were struggling to connect with her at a soul level, even take her soul, to connect body and soul with her. And she found that by emanating love to them, that they, in a sense, the demonic dimension, if you will, or the dark dimension of their consciousness was affected. They seemed to pull back from that, at the same time thrive with that. So there was this growing kind of loving connection grew out of that struggle that had been going on for several days before this session. This was there was no regression here. We're just talking. She says, referring to love, "I think it's a real power. I think it's the most powerful thing in the whole universe and every other universe that we know. I think it's what everything is made of. I think it's what started everything, and I think everything has that love in it." Barbara does not have the kind of sophisticated intellectual or spiritual background that would, a lot of what she's talking about here, if you knew her, you'd realize it had to come from something of her experience. It was not something that she had learned or through reading or through her education. She says, "I look at love as like an umbilical cord that connects my soul to the main major source where all this love comes from. That's how I look at love. It's my cord. It's my umbilical cord. It's my extension cord." Speaking of the aliens, "They seem very frail." She says, I think they're after our love and our experience, and I think they envy us, and I think they're jealous of us. I think that maybe if they try to create these half and half babies or whatever, I think maybe that's so they can use those bodies for themselves, trying to somehow, if they get enough human qualities in that body, they can use that body for themselves, and then try to get nurturing from the mothers or from someone else. Now that, I hear case after case, that they envy our dense physical embodiment. They treasure our sexuality, our nurturance, our intense physicality. So that's something that they want from us. While we in turn, they for us play this role of cracking our distance from source, our egoism. They're kind of emissaries opening us up and returning us to source. "They're like starving children who are trying to sneak in with the other kids who are the other babies who are being breastfed. I think that they remember what this felt like. They know what it feels like, and I think they want to go back to that. But for some reason, I don't know why, they can't connect to the source the way we can, and I think they have to go through us to connect to the source." Which, again, is paradoxical, because in another sense, they're emissaries from source. But what she means here is that they don't have the kind of deep, rich, physical, emotional, spiritual experience of connection with source. She says, "They have to actually be in me, and for me to give up my body or whatever, my soul, willingly, and have them come in. I think that's the only way that they can even try to connect with the source. To me, it's like they're trying to use tricks, and I don't know. I don't know why. I'll tell you one thing. I don't consider them evil in the way that, you know, we look at evil. I don't say that they're bad or good or anything like that. I think that they're just that's the way they are. I do believe we all came from the same place. I believe if we look back on religion and myths and legends, I think all the answers are there. But we've gotten to the point here where we consider ourselves so technologically advanced and so educated and just, you know, just up there, that we don't even think it's necessary to remember where we came from. We've been educated fools. I think that religion has been made into a tool that keeps us blind or that keeps us from remembering where we came from. I think Source's purpose for letting that happen, that is the beings coming and doing this, encountering us this way, this is just totally weird, but I think Source's purpose was to let us remember things, to bring back memory of us, of Source, to empower ourselves. I mean, the power has always been in there. It's always been there. It's not like Source is giving you this power now. It's always been there. It's self-realization. It's to open up your consciousness more. I think it's almost like a baby going from crawling to walking and realizing that I am. That's what I think Source's reason was for this. I am. I think there's so much more to this body. I think even our DNA, we don't even know a lot about our DNA. I think we can restructure our DNA. I think we can become what the Bible said. That in the last days, people will have new bodies, indestructible bodies. They will be new beings. And I think it's all inside of us. It's all here, this package. And I think the mind is the key. I think our minds will expand and open. And I think that whole percentage of the brain that we don't even use, we're going to remember how to use it. And I think we will free ourselves, because I don't think humans are free. We look at everything as good and bad, and oh, how can God let this happen? We look at things and think, oh my God, how horrible, how terrible. But that's because we're looking at it through these eyes. We're not looking at the whole structure. I don't think there's ever an end to anything or a real beginning to anything. I think everything just is. I think every action you look at, even sending a little kid to school for the first time, just everything we do just mimics the way Source does things. If you look at patterns in life, patterns are repeated always, over and over and over in our actions, and the way we raise our children, in the way government treats us, just everything mimics over and over and over. Where is that pattern coming from? You know, we come here with those patterns. I think that's from the main source. I guess in a way we're like a small replica of what goes on everywhere else. And I think we come here like a baby source, and we come here and we mature. We're getting ready to graduate. A lot of us are starting to wake up and remember and realize. And I think graduation time is coming up. The earth has gone through a lot. It's gone through having to support a whole kindergarten of kids, mauling it and spray painting it, crayoning it. I think this class is going to graduate, and I think the earth will have to go through a whole cleansing process, a whole cleansing period, and I think a whole new set of little sources will come through, and I think this has happened before. I think it's going to continue happening. I think it's basically what this is all about. Poison in the water, poison in the water. I keep having all these visions and dreams about the water being poisoned, the air being poisoned, plus people poison it just by being here. The way in our mentality, the way it is now, we give off almost like negative energy, and we're poisoning the planet just with that energy, because I think our Mother Earth, to me, it's like a living organism to me. It's a living organism, and we're giving off these repelling energies, and it's killing it. It's killing it. It affects the animals. It affects the insects. It affects everything. Everything. It's all of it, the trees and everything. If we're giving off this negative energy all the time, after a while, the earth looks at us as something like a harmful bacteria, and it will repel us. It will fight back. I think Mother Earth is actually fighting back. These blue baldies, that's what she calls the alien beings. I won't say they own this earth. This is their home. I think this is where they belonged first. They're the keepers, the true keepers of this earth. The little baldies, they're here too, whether they mean to or not. They're here to help us with this growth period, to help us to mature. And this is a person who's been highly traumatized by this experience. So again, this, just because it's traumatic doesn't mean that there isn't also this transcendent growth dimension. She said, I would say we're getting to a point where we're all, you know, waking up. But I think these blue baldies and Mother Earth belongs to them. And I think they were put in charge of Mother Earth, and I think they're the ones that are going to clean up. She says, it seems to me it seems that now that I'm becoming more conscious of things. It seems like there's an actual chemical reaction that's happening in the back of my brain, like something that's actually changing. Okay, in conclusion, and this is from this work, and it kind of goes off into some of the issues we've been talking about in the conference. To analogize from what the Catholic bishop said at the time when they took a policy stand against nuclear deterrence, we are destroying God's work. And the Dalai Lama, when we met with him around the alien abduction phenomenon, he says, these beings, these creatures, they're very upset. You know how he speaks. They're very upset. He says, we are destroying their spiritual home, their physical home and spiritual home. They have no choice but to become physical and come back and try to stop us. Second, the alien abduction phenomenon, it appears to be a kind of outreach program from the cosmos for the spiritually impaired. We and the beings come from a common source, and that love is at the core of the cosmos as its essential creative power. To know in this field, to know in this relationship to this subtle realm, paradoxically, and this phenomenon is filled with paradox, the appropriate attitude is one of not knowing, what the Buddhists call empty mind. Knowledge here is like the creation of the universe itself. As the universe emerged from nothing, so knowledge in this area will emerge from radical not knowing. The new paradigm we've heard so much about has to do with, I believe, a different notion of our relationship to reality, one that is co-creative, evolutionary, that we are co-creating with nature and with God. That our job at this time, all of us, is to overcome the dualism, the separateness that has characterized not only our worldview, but our scientific approaches to all of the realms that have been studied up till this point. That our job now is to integrate the polarities at every level, at the intrapsychic level, the darkness within us, as well as our transcendent, loving, spiritual selves, at the interpersonal level in terms of individual human relationships and collective relationships. Ethnic cleansing, for instance, is an example of extreme polarization, at what Eric Erickson called pseudo-speciation, as if we were not even one species. And finally, to overcome the polarities in our relationship with nature, which is the characteristic of the main characteristic of the Western worldview, that separateness from nature, so that we can explore, enjoy, travel ecstatically, lovingly, materially and non-materially, discover the unique particularities in our own being, our own nature, within the cosmos, but in the context of the experience of the essential unity and sacredness of nature. That's what I think fundamentally we are learning from this extraordinary phenomenon. Thank you very much.